Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
The Market Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell.
Hello and welcome to the Market Musings Podcast, where today our guest is James Campbell, the CEO of Botswana Diamonds. Hello, James. Welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I'm very, very good, Mark. And how are you doing on this lovely afternoon?
I'm very well, thank you. Now, you say it's a lovely afternoon. I know that you're not calling from Europe. And I mean, looking over here where I am in Europe, it's not cold, but it's getting chilly and it's a bit overcast. And Kenny, you'll normally give us a weather report from Scotland. But whereabouts are you calling from today, where it's a lovely afternoon?
Well, it's a small little village called Irene, which is halfway between Johannesburg and Pretoria in South Africa.
Okay.
And why I call it a lovely afternoon is that we've had 6 months of no rain. And we had our first rains last week after 36 degree temperatures, and it's absolutely beautiful. Spring has firmly sprung.
Excellent, excellent. And Kenny, what's it like with you? Welcome, by the way.
Yeah, welcome, welcome. Hi, James. Yeah, I wish, I think the last 3 or 4 days, if we've had 6 minutes without rain, then it would be great. Yeah, it's pretty miserable here. Last 2 or 3 days, just wind, rain, getting cold. But listen, to Scotland, that's what we expect. So still shorts weather. So I'm fine with that. I don't really care, as long as it doesn't start snowing. But you never know in Scotland. It could start in October just as well as April. It's crazy. But yeah. No, it's great to have you on the podcast, James. I mean, we've spoke before and in previous companies, and what we like to do in this podcast, James, it's not your standard, 10 question interview type podcast. What we do is we like to find out about you, because we believe you can have the best projects in the world, but if you don't have the right people running these projects, then it's never going to happen or work. So we like to let the CEO or the director have the limelight for 10-15 minutes, basically take us on a potted history of James Campbell, where you were born, what it was like growing up, how you get involved in the diamond industry, your career, your education, successes, failures, because failures are great as well, because you learn so much from failures. I certainly have in life. So it's really an opportunity, James, for you to take the floor for the next sort of 10 minutes and tell us a bit about yourself.
And feel free, James, just to jump in there, to go back as far as you like. Your LinkedIn page is incredibly detailed. I'm quite envious of it, and I wish other people would have such a LinkedIn page. I can see some early pictures of you there, and you were working Allen's Nosh Bar in Brid, which is not far from my neck of the woods. I'm originally from York, so feel free to take us back as far as you dare.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you, Kenny, and thank you for that on the LinkedIn profile. I always believe that if you're going to do one of these things, you actually ought to do it properly. And just on Alan's Nosh Bar, I could not believe when I last looked at a photograph, was it last year, which is 2020, that it looked exactly the same as when I was like a washer-upper and a cook. When I was 19 or 20 or thereabouts. It's amazing. It really is amazing.
Excellent. Are you from Yorkshire then?
No. I was born actually in Derry in Ireland, in the north of Ireland. My father was a Royal Air Force officer who was stationed there. And as you might gather when I give you a bit of my potted history, I moved wherever my father was stationed. It could have been in Yorkshire, it could have been in London, it could have been in Holland. We moved all over the place as such. And because my father's father was also in the Royal Air Force and he fought in the Second World War in North Africa, my father decided it best I go to boarding school. So at least I have a reasonable education, or at least a stab at a reasonable education. And so I spent 8 years in Suffolk, Framlingham College in Suffolk. So if anybody asks where is my home in England, I tend to say Suffolk because I went to boarding school there. And I still have very fond memories there. My brother, in fact, has got a small cottage not far away from Framlingham College. He's a lawyer who runs his own business in London. We're very close. And so where did this whole thing around diamonds kind of first start? Well, when I was at university, at the end of our second year, and I went to Imperial College, or Royal School of Mines, as we like to call it in London, you had the opportunity of Kenny going into your neck of the woods and doing some mapping on some remote Scottish island with, as you said at the very beginning, you know, 6 minutes break between the rain, or finding a job for the 3 months and writing a project about the job. And this was particularly because I was doing the mining and exploration geology stream rather than pure geology. And I was very, very lucky to land a job with De Beers for the 3 months. And my job was not a very inspiring job. It was to dig a hole in the base of a kimberlite on what was going to become Venetia Mine, which many of your listeners will know much about, fabulously profitable. And this hole I had to dig was 1 meter by 1 meter by 1 meter. And I had to dig it in 10 by 10 by 10 centimeter cubes for microdiamond analysis. But that was way beyond me at that time. All I had to do was sit at the bottom of a hole and dig out by 10 by 10 in this, at the bottom of a very hot pit in the middle of Venetia. But it gave me the opportunity to learn about diamond exploration, about South Africa, about the people who are involved with diamond exploration. And I was very pleased that once I graduated from Imperial College, that a job offer came up to go back and work for De Beers in South Africa. And I also have great family links there as well, in that my grandfather, he was the chief accountant for the Central Selling Organization in London. And in fact, he was directly recruited by Harry Oppenheimer, in that my grandfather was an old-fashioned city auditor in the middle of London. And, you know, Harry wanted my grandfather to come and work for him. But my grandfather, being a very conservative city auditor, didn't think this was a very good idea. So as legend goes, because my father's long since passed on, Harry just bought the audit firm. So my grandfather went to work for him. So when I said, asked my grandfather, I said to him, I've got, you know, two or three job offers, mud logging in the North Sea. And again, Kenny, that's not too dissimilar from the wilds of Scotland, or doing underground gold mining geology in South Africa, 2 or 3 kilometers down a pit, against diamond exploration in the field. It really wasn't much of a choice. So, and my grandfather said to me as well at the time, James, there's not much of a choice here. You will work for De Beers. So I said, yes, sir, I will. So I did. And I spent 21 years at De Beers. I must say I had a fabulous career there. I was involved with the discovery of what became three diamond mines, the Klipspringer mine, which we're working close to now with Botswana Diamonds, Maasfontein close by, and Mooikloof in the northern part of the country itself. But yeah, and then I was thinking I was just going to be, you know, follow the normal corporate ladder, going up and down, you know, up, sorry, less than down, more up along the corporate ladder in geology. But after about 15, 16 years, I was very, very fortunate and indeed blessed to be selected to become Nicky Oppenheimer's first personal assistant when he became executive chairman of De Beers. And there I got to meet Harry Oppenheimer before he passed on, and such a kind of splendid, knowledgeable man, and as is Nicky as well, and deep, deep insight into the diamond business. So I was very, very fortunate to spend 3 years doing that job. And that's probably one of the biggest highlights of my work. After that, I went on and did a brief stint as being general manager of information technology I think it's probably one of the low lights of my career. And it was actually quite simple how I ended up on that. The previous general manager of IT had moved on or got promoted. And there was a board discussion about who should take on the next job. And Nikki said that, no, James understands about computers. Perhaps he ought to do the job. So I had to do the job. But thankfully, I went back into exploration and rejoined Bill McKechnie, who was the director responsible for exploration, and ended up running their advanced exploration and global laboratories. Now, sadly, Bill retired, and I sought voluntary retrenchment from De Beers and immediately joined African Diamonds under Dr. John Teeling. And interestingly, my immediate job at De Beers was running the joint venture with African Diamonds on AK6 from a De Beers perspective. So I went into the same project essentially, but running it from a junior perspective. And then started about 4.5 to 5 years with African Diamonds. If I say that I learned all of my technical stuff at De Beers, and there were, now at that time, De Beers was the master in terms of geology, mining, metallurgy, all the technical disciplines. This was where I got to learn a lot about the corporate stuff from Dr. John Teeling. So it was really a baptism of fire. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we went through some very, very tough times with African Diamonds and AK6. There was the court case against De Beers. We launched a high court action against them when they wanted to put the project on care and maintenance. On a retention license. And there was quite a lot of drama and theatre about that. But it all ended well in that the project was approved. De Beers kind of relented. And what you now see now is the world famous kind of Karowe mine. But just in between that, though, is that the second drama of those two pieces, in between those two pieces, was when the global financial crisis came along and De Beers couldn't fund the $380 million or so to build the mines. So they gave us the opportunity to find a funder, little thinking that we would find a funder in the global financial crisis. And we did in Lucara. And we arranged for the buyout of De Beers' share of the project for $49 million, which some 7 or 8 years later was worth more than 10 times that amount. So Lucara did very well. African Diamonds shareholders made 25 times plus their money on that. Mm-hmm. I also worked for John under West Africa Diamonds, where we had gold and diamond projects in Guinea and Sierra Leone. With that company, we did a reverse takeover of Stellar Diamonds, and that has since been merged with Newfield Resources, an Australian listed company. Mm-hmm. Obviously, following the acquisition of African Diamonds by Lucara, I spent a short spell at Lucara, as one does. You know, if a company buys another company, they generally take on the CEO. And if the projects don't work out, they can bullet the CEO. But of course, I was rather superfluous to requirements because, as we all know, the project was a superb project. And so after that, I joined Mark Bristow on Rockwell Diamonds. I ran Rockwell Diamonds for 5 years. And at one stage, we were mining over 1 million tons a month of alluvial gravels in the Middle Orange River at probably one of the lowest operating costs of any diamond mining company in the world. At some point, we were around about $5 per ton. But that lasted for about 5 years. And then there was a phone call from John saying, come home, come back to Botswana Diamonds. Botswana Diamonds was created out of the exploration assets from African Diamonds. So I couldn't resist it. So since for the last 4 and a bit years, I've been working with John on Botswana Diamonds. Mm-hmm. I think that's a bit of a summary. I'm very happy to kind of dig in a bit more detail with that. Mark, Kenny?
No, well, yeah, it is a nice summary. There's an awful lot to cover, James. I think you gave us a very nice summary there of everything. So really, It's been diamonds pretty much all of your career then, has it?
It has been. I have been involved with a gold project and Mozambique. And in my spare time, I have been involved with a couple of non-profit organizations, as they call them, in South Africa. One of these is Common Purpose South Africa. It was formed just over 21 years ago. I was one of the founding directors. I'm still chairman now. And that's a leadership development organization. So I'm very, very passionate about leadership. And then I was involved with the Johannesburg Ballet, the previously called the South African Ballet Theatre, for just under 15 years. I served as a trustee and chairman for the past 5 years. And this ballet company is and was the largest ballet company in Africa. So I do get involved in a little bit of stuff outside mm-hmm. of diamonds, but my work life is chiefly diamonds. Absolutely, Mark.
Chiefly diamonds.
Yeah. I must admit, James, I mean, I've looked at your social media feeds and you just seem to be as happy as a pig in, I'll not say that word, but you want to be out in the field. That's where you're at your best, out in the field. That seems to be your passion.
Kenny, absolutely. And I just want to kind of reminisce briefly about a trip I hosted to fourth year students from a local university at the end of last year. You know, just picture this. It was about 35 degrees centigrade, very humid as well. And we had to walk down to the bottom of the pit and afterwards. And I got chatting to some of these 21, 22-year-olds about what they wanted to do once they graduated, which was literally in a month or two's time. And they said, not like you. And I said, but why? He said, no, this field work, we can't do this field work at your age. And I said that if you don't enjoy field work, along with important office work, because of course there's lots of really important office work to be done, then I don't think you actually should be a geologist, because you've got to love working in the field and being in the field, as well as doing all the other very interesting stuff a geologist brings. And if it's very hot or very cold, that just comes with the territory, I'm afraid.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, diamonds are quite it's very specialised, obviously, and it's a very strange market as well. I mean, it's a cyclical as gold and silver and other commodities. How does the diamond market work? It's quite complicated from anything I've looked at.
Kenny, you're absolutely right. And interestingly, just on your first comment, that there are very few specialists left in the diamond world itself, because to get to a resource statement, for example, for a diamond deposit, the statistics behind it are quite different and a little bit more complicated than gold, coal, and the other minerals. And it's chiefly because when you look at a diamond deposit, you look at the volume, like you would gold or coal, how many tons there are. And you would look at the grade. Gold, it's grams per ton. In diamonds, it's carats per 100 tons. And a carat comes from the carob seed, which weighs 0.2 grams. So we measure diamond deposits in terms of carats per 100 tons. But you have a third element, which you don't find in any other deposit, and that's the dollar per carat. And the dollar per carat is a function of the quality, chiefly the quality and size of the deposit. If you look at, for example, the Karowe mine, they are mining at over $400 a carat. If you look at the Rockwell mines, which I was involved with, they were mining up to $3,000 per carat. If you look at some of the deposits in Zimbabwe, such as Morangi, they're running at about $50 per carat, all because there's a different assortment of size, shape, and color. And because of that complexity, it's quite complicated for market commentators to understand what the diamond market is doing. But in a nutshell, what happened during COVID-19 and what happened post-COVID-19 is very typical of what happens when there's any kind of major black swan event, global financial crisis, 1930s depression, come what may, is that diamond prices do drop, and they drop hard and they drop fast. So in the middle of the pandemic of last year, diamond prices were 30 to 40% down. And predictably, they rebounded very fast and very, very hard. So they've recovered all of that, plus they've grown up to 10% above that. Now, it's quite simple, really, to understand why, is that you had that pent-up demand for people who wanted to get engaged, wanted to get married, wanted to celebrate, you know, a life event. And what better way to do that than buy a diamond? So after, you know, the lockdowns were eased, people just rushed out and bought diamonds. So the prices came back very hard and very fast. And so, yes, it is cyclical in that respect. It does follow world economic environment, and it is very susceptible to economic shocks.
Yeah. And what is this kind of split between, obviously, you know, gold's got its, or silver or copper's got its industrial uses. I mean, what is the kind of split for a, you know, obviously people are buying diamonds, as you say, as jewellery. What's the sort of jewellery and industrial use split?
Kenny, it's almost exclusively jewellery based, in that much of the industrial use has now been taken over by synthetics. And in fact, that the bottom end of the jewellery market, the smaller and lesser quality stones, has started to be eroded by synthetics too as well. And so what that has meant from a natural diamond market perspective is that those diamond mines and those diamond producers which produce small and poorer quality diamonds have seen quite a significant drop in price. But in effect, how I see it is that the diamond market is maturing, like the ruby and sapphire and pearl and all the other kind of precious stones, where for many years now, you can go into a shop and you can buy a synthetic ruby, or you can buy a pure natural ruby. And they have two very, very different price points. And a lot depends on you know, what do you want as an individual? And you know, if you want to buy something that's made in an industrial press, then you buy the synthetic one. If you want to buy one that's, you know, evolved in the bowels of the earth over 3.5 billion years ago, then you buy a natural one. It's an individual choice now.
And yeah, and just on that, I mean, maybe it's a silly question, maybe, but the process of making synthetic is effectively by compressing carbon, isn't it, under extreme pressure, which is effectively the same way that they are made in the natural world. I mean, what determines the value? Is it simply that one is natural and one is not natural? I mean, in terms of what they look like, how they feel and the properties, are they very similar?
Mark, it's a really, really good question. Because when you go into a jewellery store, unless you have an instrument that can help you differentiate between a synthetic and a natural, you will not be able to know. I've been in the diamond business now for over 35 years. I would not be able to tell the difference merely by looking at by hand. But the instruments they have, and De Beers market something called the Diamond Shore. Maybe my information is a bit out of date, but it's something like that, where you put your diamond underneath this, and then you can see whether it's natural or synthetic. And the crisp difference is that synthetic diamonds are absolutely perfect because they are, and they're all the same. Whereas a natural diamond will have, even if it's at the highest price point, will have some natural imperfections in it because of the way it was produced in, you know, from the bottom end of the mantle and the kind of pressures and temperatures which it was subjected to as it came from the mantle all the way through until the crust and exploded.
Right. Okay. So yeah. So and when you say like absolutely perfect, what do you mean by that?
The crystal structure will be very exact.
Right. Okay.
And it will have no, you might find, for example, in diamonds, tiny little inclusions of garnet, of chromium dioxide, of other minerals, which you might not be able to see by the naked eye, but they would be there. And it would not have necessarily an absolutely perfect crystal structure.
Okay, I see. And what's it like then to actually explore for diamonds then? I know you know, certainly modern mining techniques, as we're hearing a lot about these days with a lot of the companies we speak to in precious and base metals, are using EM surveys and able to look under the surface of the earth and find these magnetic anomalies, and then they can do targeted drilling. But what is it like to actually explore for diamonds? Where do you start, and what techniques do you have at your disposal?
Well, we target areas, what they call cratons, which are basically very, very old blocks of crust where you would find kimberlites. Kimberlite would be the host rock for diamond. And the difference between a kimberlite and the volcanoes that you see now erupting is that the origin of the kimberlitic lava is much, much deeper than the origin of the basaltic lava, like you would see at Mauna Loa and Mauna Kea in Hawaii, Mount Vesuvius, Mount St. Helens, and the Ring of Fire of Japan, and those kind of things. And if one kind of breaks that down into numbers, that there are roughly about 6,000 kimberlites in the world, of which 600 contain diamonds, of which 60 have been or are diamond mines. So a lot depends on when the kimberlite, as it comes from the mantle into the crust, does it entrain diamond megacrysts or eclogites as it comes up, or does it not? If you look at, for example, the Arapa cluster of kimberlites, there are about 60 kimberlites in the Arapa cluster, of which six are mines. And I would imagine, and I haven't got the exact detail behind, but there are probably another 15 or 20 which are diamondiferous, but the rest are completely barren. And they all erupted over the same geological period, but many millions of years apart. So a lot would depend on whether they would entrain those diamonds or not. So how do you find them? The two primary area technologies are geophysics, and there we look at magnetics, electromagnetics, and gravity. Those are the three kind of major areas. And then secondly, heavy mineral sampling. Kimberlites contain a number of what they call kimberlitic minerals, which are ubiquitous to kimberlite. So if, for example, we go into the middle of the Kalahari, where Botswana Diamonds is working at the moment, you've got 60 meters or so of Kalahari sand sitting on top of the kind of hard rock, which is mostly basalt in that area. So you would use geophysics to begin with to see through the sand, to look for circular shaped anomalies, for want of a better word. And they're not all going to be kimberlite, far from it. They could be all sorts of other different things. And once you've found those targets, you then take very, very detailed sampling to see if you can pick up the kimberlitic indicators. And here you're relying on the tiny termite, which often buries tens of meters down into the sand, and they may bring up kimberlitic indicators. So you might find in a 30-liter or 100 liters of sand, one or two tiny little garnets, which would actually help you pinpoint that kimberlite. So it's a very, very precise game in order to find the kimberlite.
Is the kimberlite, is it magnetic then? Is it metal?
There are two types of kimberlites, Mark. One is called a group one, and they are magnetic.
Okay.
And another one is called a group two. And these, because they don't have ilmenite in them, are not magnetic. So group two kimberlites do tend to be harder to find.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Cool. Excellent. Yeah. Well, that's we've covered quite a bit in the half an hour there, James. Obviously, we've got your backstory, and then we've done some nice educational stuff. I've certainly learned a lot in the last 10 minutes about diamonds and diamond exploration. And I suppose that kind of leads us quite nicely on to Botswana Diamonds. I know we could probably spend, you know, another half an hour, 40 minutes talking about the company, but it'd be nice just to, as part of this podcast, to give us a general overview of the company and what the key projects are within the company.
Now, absolutely, Kenny. We've got two major areas of focus, and seeing that I've just spoken about the Kalahari of Botswana, that is the kind of primary area of focus. And the Kalahari of Botswana is basically the middle part of Botswana, which is essentially a desert. And we've got a number of different projects there. The first one, probably the most important one at this stage, is our joint venture with Vast Resource on the Gargu Diamond Mine, which we have made an offer to acquire and is currently going through regulatory approval processes. 60 kilometers away from that is the KX36 deposit, which was found by Petra. Many other people did look over the area, but Petra had, you know, did really precise and detailed work and found KX36. And this is an even higher graded kimberlite, not so far away from Gargou. And then we have a two companies. One's called Sunland Minerals, which has got a number of prospecting licenses in the Kalahari itself. And we've got a participation interest in something called Maiibwe on a number of kimberlites called the Kikatsi Kau kimberlites in the southwest of the Kalahari. And then on top of that, we have a strategic alliance with a local company called Diamextrat Botswana, along with Burgundy Diamond Mining of Australia, where there's a farm-in arrangement on our prospecting licenses and anything discovered as a result of our data, because we have the second largest diamond exploration data pack in Botswana. So Botswana's, you know, as you hear now, is a very key focus for us.
Yeah.
And then in South Africa, we are very focused on the Thorny River Advanced Exploration Project, which is some 3 hours north of where I'm living. And that is quite a different beast. There we're looking for much, much smaller kimberlites, but very high grade. I mentioned Maasfontein somewhere towards the beginning of my podcast there. And that had was famous for actually having a 3.5-day payback. And you know, we're looking with very precise and detailed exploration work about looking for another Maasfontein if we can. And we've already found two blows, which we're in the process of modeling and doing mine planning on.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly a lot going on in Botswana Diamonds at the moment. So the focus is always, I mean, obviously the company's called Botswana. It's Africa only. Is it Africa only focus for the company?
Well, at the moment, Kenny, absolutely. Diamonds, you know, they occur all over the world as such. So Botswana Diamonds' focus is on Southern Africa, you know, where, you know, we can manage things from my home base in Irene. I mentioned about Botswana. I mentioned about South Africa. We have a joint venture with Vast Resources in Zimbabwe. Yeah, yeah. So when Zimbabwe eventually opens up to, you know, more transparent business in the diamond space, will be very active there. And of course, you have Lesotho and Eswatini, previously called Swaziland, which are also countries within Southern Africa, which host primary diamond deposits.
Yep. And just there's one thing I meant to ask, just when you were doing your site educational piece, we'll come back to Botswana Diamonds in a minute, James, but what is the difference between a kimberlite dike and a pipe, or are they the same thing? You're probably going to get me into trouble for saying that, but
no, exactly not. Dikes are basically they could be anything from a few centimeters to a few meters wide, long, thin bodies. Mm-hmm. That's what they are. And what a pipe is essentially, if you look at a carrot, is a blow or a pipe that's exploded from a dike, because dikes occur at the root zone of kimberlites. So if you just imagine Mount Vesuvius, because everyone should have heard of or know of Mount Vesuvius or Mount Etna or any of the large volcanoes which are erupting now. In many millions of years' time, that magma would have solidified and be a carrot shaped. If you go down half a kilometer or a kilometer or so, you'll see a number of kimberlite dikes. I mean, not kimberlite. You'll see a number of igneous magmatic dikes at the bottom of it, because that's where the kind of the feeder zones from the pipe actually erupted. And why we find dikes on the surface now is that, you know, of the tremendous amount of erosion. They're talking about, for example, about a kilometer of erosion in the Thorny River area from when the kimberlite blows and dikes first erupted to where they actually are now. I hope that makes some kind of sense.
Yeah, no, definitely understand it a bit more. Like I said earlier on, you know, diamonds is so specialized, it's it's there's not much, as you said as well, there's not a great deal of market commentary out there. There's, you know, people struggle to understand it sometimes. So from an investor point of view, it's great for you to get this information out there, and then people can get a more of a balanced investment decision. So jumping back to Botswana Diamonds then, so obviously the roadmaps for the companies just now are a bit up in the air because COVID's still, restrictions are still hampering companies. What's it looking like for the next 6 months in Botswana Diamonds? What's the plans? What we got in the, what can investors look forward to news-wise?
Well, there are a number of things, Kenny, and I think if investors go and look at the Botswana Diamond website or the Twitter handle, you'll see that we do put out our news releases now, our commitments, which we try and honor on a regular basis. So in terms of importance, we're going through the regulatory approvals on Gargu right now. And one of the great things about working in Botswana is, it's a very strong rule of law and things don't take a long time there, which is great. Yeah. So we hope to make announcements with regard to the regulatory approvals there. The second thing is we hope to make an announcement on the work program by Dimextrat and Burgundy on our exploration licenses, because the guys there have been very, very active in looking at the vast database to come up with new target areas. And then thirdly, we've begun to put together a three-dimensional geological model of the river and the river extension blows on Thorny River, and we'll start to do some simulated mine planning on that too as well. So those are kind of the three major things which investors can look forward to during the next quarter or so.
Yep, and I'm just looking at the market cap as well. So it's about £8-9 million market cap. How does that sit with your peers? I'm not 100% up to speed with the diamond explorers. Where do you sit amongst your peers?
Kenny, it's a very, very good question. That in 2000, pre the global financial crisis in 2009, there were probably 10 times more of my peers than there are now.
Yeah.
We are the only listed diamond explorer on the London Stock Exchange AIM market in Southern Africa. Would you believe that? In South Africa, there is Blue Rock Diamonds, which is mining the Kerifle kimberlites. They're listed on London AIM. You obviously have Gem Diamonds, which is mining the Letseng Diamond Deposit in Lesotho. And then the other companies happen to be Canadian. You've obviously got Lucara Diamond Corporation, which we mentioned is mining Karowe. And then you have a company called Pangolin Diamonds, which is a diamond explorer in Botswana. So the only really active junior exploration in Southern Africa is probably being done by Pangolin and ourselves. And we're probably a little bit bigger than Pangolin. But then if you go to the Canadian and the Australian markets, where there are many more diamond juniors or diamond junior explorers operating. Some of them are significantly larger with probably similar projects than us. Others are considerably smaller. So we probably sit somewhere in the middle as such.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's definitely something for me to look into. Like I say, it's not a commodity I've really spent a lot of time on. So yeah, I might need to do a bit of Googling and then jump on your Twitter feed, James, and have a look and see what you're up to.
Yeah, Mark, and knowing Kenny's magpie tendencies, it would not surprise me if he really goes to town on this and starts investing in diamonds, and he'll be telling me and showing me pictures of all the diamonds he's got arriving at his house and sending me a website so I can buy some as well.
Yeah, I do have a silver collection, James, so I do. But diamonds are a bit dearer than silver, so
a little bit dearer.
But I think, Mark, this would be quite a good opportunity to put James in the spot with a 60-second challenge. I'll maybe let you explain it and see if he's up for it.
Yeah, sure. So are you up for 60 seconds, James, of making a bit of a elevator pitch for Botswana Diamonds as to why investors might consider or should consider investing in the company with what's what you're exploring for and what you think might be coming, and the investment proposition in under 60 seconds? What do you think?
I'll have a crack at that, Mark. I can't resist the temptation. I've now just taken my watch off so I can see the second hand properly if my eyes will allow me to see that far.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll count you down in 3, 2, 1. Off you go.
Well, the first thing is, why do you invest in diamonds? Diamonds are the ultimate symbol of love, and natural diamonds are even more the ultimate symbol of love. The number of diamond mines in the world are diminishing. So the price of diamonds is increasing as the middle class of the populations around the world increase. So diamond exploration is where we look for primary diamond deposits, which will eventually become diamond mines. And with that introduction around diamonds itself, diamonds are a great area to invest in. And Botswana Diamonds, which is active in southern Africa, is home to some of the world's largest diamond deposits, but is equally home to some of the area's largest prospective areas of exploration. And Botswana Diamonds has got the track record and team through African Diamonds and other companies to deliver on that promise.
Oh, yeah, perfect.
We got a bit tongue twisted there, I think, but I hope it's okay.
good. No, that was good. Yeah, bang on 60 seconds. I think that that's a record, that, isn't it, Kenny? We have very few people who've managed to do that.
Yeah, I think we had somebody going for 3 minutes before, so we have, but we just let them go on. We don't stop them. it doesn't really matter as long as they get their story out there, but. No, it's certainly been an education for me, James, and it'd be great to have you back on again, and we can maybe go back into some of these details in more depth, because we've just kind of scraped the surface, for want of a better term.
Oh, so. Kenny, I'd be delighted. It's always great chatting to you and Mark on this area, and as you could probably gather, that you know, diamonds are my real passion, and I have to sometimes be told to be quiet because I'm talking too much about them.
Yeah, but that it's great to feel that passion, James. You know that it's infectious as well, and I think it's a great time as well, isn't it? With the diamond market sort of turning now post this COVID era that we've gone through, some good news recently with the prospecting licenses renewed. How are you feeling in the short term about what's going on at Botswana Diamonds?
I'm feeling actually very optimistic that. I recall a conversation I had with my chairman around about April of last year about what are we going to do? You know, you can't get out to the field because of the COVID lockdowns around the world. And so here we are a year and a half later. We've done a number of acquisitions. We acquired Petra Diamonds' assets in Botswana called Sekaka Diamonds. We did a joint venture with Burgundy and Dimextrat on many of those assets. We have conditionally acquired the Gargu diamond mine with vast resources in Botswana. And then fourthly, just last week, we announced the buyout of the minorities on Vitomi. So we've been able to be very, very active from a corporate perspective. But whenever there's been a slight lapse change in the regulations in this part of the world, we have been able to get out and do some field work too as well. So it's been a challenge. And I think that's how, you know, our board saw this, is that we tend to be a little bit contrarian. We saw this as a time of opportunity, whilst many didn't. So let's get out there and see what we can actually do.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to following the story. And as Kenny says, yeah, maybe we should get you back on in the not too distant future to discuss more about diamonds but also what's going on at Botswana. But James, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much indeed, Mark and Kenny, for having me. Much appreciated.
No problem. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.
Stop.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.